This is IAQ Radio, Indoor Air Quality Radio, the voice of the indoor air quality industry, with your host, Radio Joe Hughes, and the Z-Man, Cliff Zlotnick.
IAQ Radio Association sponsors are AIHA, the American Industrial Hygiene Association, at AIHA.org. IICRC, the Institute for Inspection, Cleaning, and Restoration Certification, at IICRC.org. The Restoration Industry Association, RIA, at RestorationIndustry.org. The Environmental Information Association, EIA, at EIA-USA.org. IAQ Radio industry sponsors are Particles Plus at ParticlesPlus.com, BioPlanet at BYOPlanet.com, Actionable Insights at GetInsights.org.
And now you can win a cool prize. It's time for the IAQ Radio trivia question. Be the first to correctly answer. Simply email your answer to czlotnick at cs.com. Or if listening live, just text your answer from your computer. And now, here's the Z-Man.
Hello, everyone. Here's today's IAQ Radio trivia question. What are the four routes of chemical exposure? Back to you, Joe.
All right. Larry Sloan has served as the CEO of the American Industrial Hygiene Association since 2016. He began his career as a chemical engineer at Air Products and later worked for Nalco Chemical Company. He earned his BS degree in chemical engineering from the University of Pennsylvania and later graduated from Northwestern University's Kellogg Graduate School of Management, where he earned his MBA. Larry is a certified association executive through the American Society of Association Executives, and in 2021, he was appointed a fellow of that organization. Welcome back, Larry. Great to see you.
Great to be here. Thanks very much, Joe.
Oh, I know you've been on the road, so we appreciate you jumping in the saddle here for us so quick after a quick turnaround from Chicago. Larry, we want to talk today about this book, e-book, I guess it would be, on, you know, healthier workplaces and schools. But let's start by just, why was it developed and who were the key players? And tell us a little bit about what's called Commit to Care.
Yeah. So thanks again for having me. It's always a pleasure, Joe and Cliff. The whole Commit to Care, and CARE stands for Community, Accountability, Responsibility, and Equity. And so Commit to Care came out of a multi-year grant that we have been receiving from the CDC. And if I step back, the grant came from the work we did at the beginning of the pandemic on this Back to Work Safely initiative. I think my first appointment or my first appearance here back in 2021 was to talk about Back to Work Safely. Because remember, back in the beginning months of the pandemic, there wasn't a lot of practical guidance that was being produced to help small businesses safely reopen. And so we formed the task force, and the task force literally produced 20 different guidance documents under the Back to Work Safely brand within a few weeks. And so by the spring, summer of 2020, we had 27 different Back to Work Safely guidance documents. Well, since then, all of those 27 Back to Work Safely guidance documents have been updated and now forms this ebook. And the ebook is called Healthier Workplaces and Schools, which I understand is the kind of the focal point of this webcast. But Commit to Care is really the web portal where the ebook and a lot of other resources are available. And that all came out of that CDC grant. And so,
there's a pretty impressive group of organizations that are a part of a Commit to Care. I think Grayson can pull that up for us, and maybe you could mention a few of these groups that came together to pull this off.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you click on partners, you'll see a list of all of the different associations and organizations that are committed to Commit to Care. And so what we've done, gentlemen, is, you know, we went out and we, you know, explained the purpose of Commit to Care is to provide a repository of freely available information that takes the complexities of the science and really simplifies the messaging to a business owner, a small business owner that doesn't have an on-staff industrial hygienist. And so when you look at the variety of associations ranging from ACGIH to to the AACOM, the OCC Physicians, American Bio Recovery Association, American Public Health Association, the Australian Association, the British Association, SHEMA. All of these associations play a role in communicating basic fundamental guidance to help small businesses navigate the control of an infectious disease.
And we also have a link to the IBEC, the Integrated Bioscience and Built Environment Consortium. If you could pull that up there, maybe you could talk just a little more about this, Larry.
Yeah, sure. So IBEC is a 501c3 organization. So we're a 501c6, but we're both nonprofits. And really the mission of IBEC is to help bridge that gap between proven scientific processes and real world applications for people to gather healthy gatherings in the built space. And they've created a series of programs that help educate folks on how to mitigate airborne transmission. And so they had hosted their first online clean summit back in the summer of 2020. And the purpose at that time was to really expose the issues of airborne transmitted disease. Remember back then, there was a lot of confusion as to large particles and small particles and how these things are actually transmitted in the workplace. And so their goals were really to assess the pain points that people were feeling at the time and the challenges that were being faced by all these different types of industries to help reduce the risk of viral transmission in the workplace. And after those two first Clean Summit webinars, they published some summary articles. And, you know, while they were doing this in 2020, we were publishing these Back to Work Safely guidance documents in parallel. We didn't know what they were doing. They didn't know what we were doing. When we officially got the first tranche of funding from the CDC in February of 2021 was when we got the first $500,000 grant. We became very familiar with IBEC during the latter part of the summer of 2020. And we were talking to them and they were talking to us. We started exchanging notes. And so when we got the grant, we felt that they would be the perfect partner to help us put together the various assets that now makes up Commit to Care. So the video vignettes that we produced, downloadable flyers and brochures, the online risk assessment tool, we'll talk about that a little bit later. IBEC was really kind of the brains behind putting that material together. And then we, you know, in tandem with our communication outreach, it's really been a really great combination of resources.
And I want to just read a little summary of what we're going to talk about today here that came from the ebook. It's viruses that transmit as airborne particles, such as viruses that cause COVID-19, flu, and measles, can pose a significant risk as they sometimes fit into spaces nearly 10,000 times smaller than a human hair, mm-hmm. travel distances of 20 to 30 feet, and stay active in the air for at least 4 hours. How good is the science on flu, measles, and their spread being via airborne exposure?
You know, I would say several years ago, I would say it was not that great, but we have seen a significant evolution in the thinking of how airborne transmitted viruses actually function. There's been a lot of recent studies, and I'll talk about a brand new WHO report that literally just came out a couple weeks ago. But the science on airborne transmission of flu and measles and other airborne viruses is quite robust, and I think it's very well established. You know, we know that viruses, they're primarily spread through respiratory droplets. They're expelled when you cough or sneeze or talk. The droplets remain suspended in the air for a long period of time, sometimes hours, like you said. And they can then be inhaled by others that are nearby or not so nearby because these particles can recirculate through your HVAC system. One particular study that was seminal was actually back in 2019, and it was authored by Milton Moraska. There were two individuals, Dan Milton and Dr. Moraska. And the publication was called, It is Time to Address Airborne Transmission of Coronavirus. And this was published, like I said, just a few years ago. And then recently, WHO just came out with a publication called Indoor Airborne Risk Assessment in the Context of SARS-CoV-2. And I want to just, if you have a minute here, I just want to quote something from this executive summary in this WHO report that I think speaks to the evolution of the science. Okay. And it says, in quotes, it says that the SARS-CoV-2 virus can spread in several ways, through zoonotic transmission, direct and indirect contact transmission, direct deposition transmission, and inhalation or airborne transmission. And then it goes on to talk about the increasing body of evidence that suggests that these viruses are transmitted through infectious fluids that are released from an infected individual, such as particles of different sizes and quantities, through breathing, speaking, coughing, and sneezing. And then it goes on and talks about smaller sized particles that do float around in the air for hours on end.
You know, it's interesting that we're focused on the airborne exposure now. And I wonder if that has been to the detriment of other types of exposure, like contact exposure. You know, I don't see much on hand washing anymore. And I know people like Ed Light, who I noticed was on here, feel like, you know, the science is strong for hand washing, et cetera. Was that considered in the document? Is that in the document?
Yeah, you know, I think that the good hygiene and washing of surfaces and washing your hands after you touch a surface is still a very good practice. And so we do talk about cleaning and disinfection in the workplace as one of several strategies. However, I will tell you that the experts have indicated that the chances of catching, say, for example, COVID, by touching your hand to a table, a desk, and then basically taking your finger and touching your nose or your eye or your mouth, the probability of contact and infection from that mode or modality is less than breathing in these particles in the air. So we're not saying that, no, don't keep things clean, but that whole kind of concept that we call it hygiene theater. Remember when the folks were going into the subway stations in New York City and they were spraying everything down and everything was being cleaned every 20 minutes? I think, you know, while hygiene is an important element to proper mitigation of transfer or the transmission of viruses, it's really more about the quality of the air in the indoor built environment and the filtration and the other methods that can be done to mitigate the concentration of particles, including viral particles in the air. That, to me, is more paramount to the transmission of the virus in the first place.
Okay. And I take another quote from, I believe this is from the ebook. It says, your job, and meaning the people in charge of these facilities, is to create as many barriers as possible to reduce the ability of a virus spread through ventilation, workplace policies, physical distancing, and masks. These four barrier opportunities don't include filtration. Where does filtration fall into that?
Actually, we do reference filtration in the ebook. I double-checked the other day, and that would fall into, I would say, an engineering control. And so when you look at the ebook, we do reference the hierarchy of controls. And we had done this in the original Back to Work Safely guidance, but we've really reemphasized the importance of following the hierarchy of controls. And I think everybody who's listening in on this call understands what they are. And really, when you're talking about airborne transmission mitigation, obviously elimination of the hazard is the number one strategy, right? It's the number one, it's top of the hierarchy of controls pyramid, and that's the first step that you want to do to help mitigate the transfer. And that could be things like pre-screening your staff, your employees, to make sure you don't have sick folks that are coming in the office in the first place. But absent of that, there's engineering controls, which is really where air filtration falls into play, UV disinfection, increasing your outside air, if you will, your circulation of air, your air changes per hour, or your CADR rate. And then you get into mitigation measures like administrative controls, and then, of course, at the bottom, your PPE. So I would say that filtration is an important element of the engineering controls, but we kind of view this as this, you probably have heard the analogy of the Swiss cheese. There's a diagram. You've got the host and the receptor, right? And so the host is sneezing, and you have these graphical, if you will, representation of particles floating through the air towards the recipient. And then you have these parallel slices, if you will, of Swiss cheese. And the Swiss cheese, as you know, has holes in different places. And so the more layers of Swiss cheese you have between the host and the recipient, the greater the opportunity for those tiny little particles to be trapped, right? To be captured between those slices of Swiss cheese. And I think that's analogous to what we're talking about when you think of these four barrier opportunities, these engineering controls, the administrative controls, and the PPE controls, and as well as the elimination controls at the top of the pyramid to help reduce the transmission of those particles from the host to the receptor.
Okay, so we've got engineering controls, including like ventilation and filtration, workplace policies, physical distancing, which can be, that can be tough at times, depending on the situation. You and Cliff and I were talking before the show about airplane flights and, you know, getting on buses and things like that. That physical distancing can be tough. The fourth one was masking. And I'm just curious, was there a lot of discussion about including masking? I know it's been controversial. And how strong is the evidence supporting masking?
Yeah, there was a lot of discussion about masking. And, you know, the industrial hygiene profession, like many other professions, there's a spectrum of folks on the credibility scale, if you will, right? I mean, there are folks within our membership who said that everybody and anybody needs to be outfitted with an N95. And I'll be honest with you, that's just not practical. It's just not practical. First of all, you need to be fit properly. And, you know, how are we going to fit folks in companies where they're not mandated by OSHA to do proper fit testing? And so folks are going to be wearing N95s improperly. And if you wear an N95 improperly, it really doesn't do a lot of benefit to you. And so what we decided to do was to suggest that, look, if you're not in as a high-risk setting as, say, a hospital or perhaps a long-term care facility, where you might have a higher incidence of COVID cases, we do recommend that you mask. Now, you could use a surgical mask or you could use a common cloth mask. Now, granted, the efficiency and the efficacy of those surgical and other face coverings is not as robust as an N95. Even the KN95 respirators, if you will, or masks, you've seen them out there. I used to wear one all the time during the midst of the pandemic. And, you know, they're better than, say, a conventional cloth face covering, but they're not as robust as an N95. But we decided to put masking into the guidance because we do believe that a mask, even if it's a one-layer mask, does provide some level of protection against airborne transmission. It's not great. It might only be 40 to 50% as effective as an N95, but NIOSH has done a variety of studies where they've had mannequins set up in the lab and they've had simulated particles transmitted from the host to the recipient. And they show different scenarios where they had an N95 on the host and the recipient. And then they did a surgical mask on the host and the recipient. And then finally they did a common face covering on the host and the recipient. And they measure the transmission of the particles and the possibility of those particles being received and ingested or inhaled by the recipient. And there was definitely a benefit to any kind of face covering, even a common cloth face covering. And so we thought, again, it's not ideal. We're going to recommend it as one of those layers, one of those slices of Swiss cheese to help mitigate the transmission.
Cliff, let me let you jump in here. I think you might have a follow-up.
Yeah, I do. Getting back to, let's go back to the beginning. You know, you put the document together, and what I'm trying to determine is whether or not it's a proactive document that kind of suggests proactivity before something happens, or a reactive document in the event that something happens maybe elsewhere. So could you comment on that?
That is an excellent question. So Cliff, the pandemic broke in, I guess, theoretically, it broke the end of February 2020. And by the middle of March, remember, everything shut down. And here's AIHA, and, you know, we're all working from home. And there's a lot of anxiety and a lot of fear. And the government indicates that everything's going to shut down except for, you know, the most mission critical establishments. Nobody knows what's going on. There isn't really a lot of guidance that's being published by the government. A task force has been established by then President Trump. And we knew that we had to do something to provide common sense guidance because there was so much confusion about, first, remember, they were saying, don't wear any masks in the beginning. Remember, CDC and WHO and other establishments were saying, don't worry about masks, make sure everything's clean, wash your hands. And that was the end of it. And then we realized pretty soon that that was not good guidance. And so the IH profession knew that airborne transmission, like the first SARS back in 1998-99, was the way to go. And so we literally formed a task force in the end of March of 2020. And we said we have got to produce some common sense guidance that does focus on airborne transmission, health and hygiene and so forth, cleaning of surfaces. Yes, we'll mention that. But it's got to be about airborne transmission. It's got to be about engineering controls. It has to be about PPE, which does include masks. And we need to get this guidance out as quickly as possible. So in the spring of 2020, it was completely reactive to your question. We were pulling together the experts within the profession, and we literally developed guidance document by guidance document, each one tailored to a different industry sector. The first industry sector we did was restaurants and bars, because restaurants had to stay open. And even though they were all doing takeout, there were people that were still working in the restaurants to prepare the food and to deliver the food to their customers. So one by one, we picked industries that were, you know, that were most mission critical to society. Restaurants and bars, hair and nail salons, which opened within the next, you know, within 6 to 8 weeks, a lot of hair and nail salons began to open again. Gymnasium, some of them stayed closed for a little longer than others. And so forth and so on. And so by the summer of 2020, we had about, like I said, about 27 different documents that were each tailored to different industry sectors. As we evolved the documents through 2020 into 2021, when we released the version 2.0, we realized that we needed to harmonize the guidance, because these had really been developed by different teams of people over a very short amount of time. And so they weren't all exactly, you know, initially harmonized in 2020. So we kind of cleaned everything up, harmonized the guidance, made sure that we reinforced the concept of the hierarchy of controls. And then in 2021, really released the version 2.0, and then began to really add more proactive measures. And we got more heavily involved in recommending the engineering controls. You got to instill higher MERV filters, right? 13 or above. You got to increase your airflow. You got to increase your outdoor air circulation. If you can open windows, please do it. If you can install a UV disinfection system in the room within the HEPA filter, those Rosenthal boxes, remember those makeshift DIY boxes became popular in 2021. And so the proactivity to our guidance really evolved in 21 and into 22, and is now reflected in the ebook that was released at the end of 2023, because we've learned over the years that there are proactive measures that you can take that are more on the engineering controls side of things, not just about slapping a mask on somebody, which is a little more reactive. It's actually improving the quality of the indoor air, so you don't have to be so concerned about everybody wearing a mask.
Thank you.
All right, let's review real quick the four D's: density, distance, dilution, and duration. Can you touch on some of the things that went into consideration when you developed that four D's?
Yeah, this was, I thought, a very ingenious way to communicate the complexities of the science into terms that the public would understand. And so this actually came from our partners at IBEC, and their thought leaders were sitting around the table at the beginning of the grant, again, flashback to February of 2021. And we were having a call with them to kind of lay out what kind of products are we going to deliver. You know, we had submitted a grant application to the CDC, and we had all these grandiose ideas on, you know, the different types of knowledge products that we would be generating over the next several months. Excuse me, and we decided that we got to keep it really, really simple. And we decided that, and they came up with this, the four D's would be a kind of a handy, easy to understand, if you will, kind of a moniker to help first identify what are the two primary risk factors in the airborne transmission of things like COVID. And so they came up with duration and density. And duration is, as you can imagine, it's a measure of how long somebody is in a room. And the longer amount of time that somebody is spending indoors with other people, the greater the probability that they're going to be inhaling air that may have been contaminated by somebody else. And the risk of transmission when you're indoors is typically much higher than when you're outdoors. Density is, of course, the number of people that are in a space, and then how many of them are not vaccinated, or how many of them are sick, but they're asymptomatic. How many of them are not wearing masks? They're wearing masks. What kind of mask are they wearing? And so when you think about the risk factors behind the transmission of COVID, duration and density were the two primary factors that affect that possibility of transmitting the virus. And then on the flip side, how do you manage the risk? So that's kind of the reactive side, is the duration and the density. And how do you manage risk is more on the proactive side of things. And those are distance and dilution. So distancing is a measure how far are people located from one another? If you're an infected individual, you're going to be exhaling a higher number of viral particles. And so if you're closer to somebody else, that's going to increase your risk of infection. Farther away, you're going to lower your risk. Dilution is all of the engineering controls. It's opening up your windows if you can to let that fresh air in. It's increasing the air changes per hour or the air per person in the room. You're hearing a lot more now about basically the airflow per individual, which is the ASHRAE 241 standard. And we're getting away from air changes per hour because the air changes per hour doesn't figure in the density of folks in a particular space. So if you can reduce the virus concentration by diluting the air, using a good HVAC system that adds in outdoor air, filtered recirculated air, possibly using a UV a GI system to help disinfect and kill those particles as they're recirculating in the built space. Those are engineering measures that basically speak to the concept of dilution. So once again, you have duration and density, which are your risk factors, and then you have your risk management factors. That would be your distance and your dilution.
I thought it was interesting and I would imagine pretty effective to include an interactive risk assessment tool. So like a risk quiz. And yeah. I was thinking if we could get Grayson to pull that up now, maybe you could go through this risk quiz with our audience and kind of explain where it came from and how you would use it.
Yeah, so the online, again, we're trying to keep things really simple. And the online risk assessment tool is based on a study that was created by Professor Sitsema, University of Illinois, Chicago. And basically, the process that we followed was a simplified version of some more complex methodology, where we're looking at the likelihood of exposure to the virus, so the density. And then we get into the duration, time that one might be exposed to the virus in an indoor space. So as you walk through the questions, you'll see, first question is, most people who frequent my organization's building are vaccinated or can be assumed to be vaccinated. So pick one of these choices and let's move on to the next
question. Let's go B.
Okay.
Partially.
I think that's fair. Question number two, people who frequent my organization's building space generally stay at least 6 feet apart from one another. So this is speaking to the density. How close together are people in a particular space? So let's go ahead and pick B again.
Okay.
Number three, now we get into PPE. People who frequent my organization's building space wear properly fitted masks. How many times have you seen an individual wearing a mask below their nose? The chin doesn't transmit the virus. So it's got to be properly fitted, right?
Let's put C on that one. Inaccurate. I think it's pretty rare anymore.
All right. And then finally, question four, the average amount of time that you're spending in that particular space.
Let's say C.
Is that one time or is that the total accumulation in a day?
So that would be in, let's say if you're going in and out of a space, you would probably answer that less than C. You might answer that B. But if you're in a particular room for an entire work shift, for the most part, right, then I would indicate more than 6 hours. But a lot of times people are coming and going, and so I would probably indicate B in that particular question. Unless you're, you know, you have a desk job or, you know, you're working in a particular setting where you're not leaving that particular space for, you know, hours upon end. So here's our answer. So the risk of exposure for that particular scenario is moderate. And so what we've done here in the risk tool is we've identified, again, the source, the pathway, and the receptor. And that's what I mentioned earlier in this call is, you know, these are the three, if you will, factors that are the fundamental underscoring of how the virus transmits from a person A to person B. And so because our risk here is considered moderate, we're under control band B. And so it does suggest that you should prioritize your mitigation strategies regarding the source. You should, you know, look at, and you look down further on the page, how do you manage risk at the source? So you want to add dilution to the room. If you bring in more fresh air, you increase your air circulation rates. You bring in a HEPA filter. You might want to make sure that you have the sick person wearing a properly fitted mask or a respirator. adding a little more spacing between folks in that room. Then we get into the pathway strategy. How do you manage and mitigate the risk in the pathway? So again, we talk about filtration, adding more fresh air and so forth, and then the receptor. So these are some common sense strategies that would be provided based on moderate risk on how we answered those previous four questions. You know, this is a very, very basic risk tool. We didn't want to make it overly complex because you make it too complex, people are not going to understand it. So we try to keep it as fundamental as possible.
Larry, this would be a great, I mean, it's a great tool for a lot of people, but I think schools in particular really need something like this. And I've always been curious. You got a grant from, I think it was CDC, the group did. Now, do they provide you or do they somehow contact by email or whatever every school district in the country to let them know this is available or send this to them in some way? Is that something, am I dreaming?
You are dreaming. I tell you what, if that would happen, I would buy you a very expensive dinner. unfortunately, that is not what happens. And so one of the challenges, these are excellent questions. One of the challenges that AIHA has had, and you know, we keep pivoting, how do we communicate out all of this great information? Because me talking to you guys about this today is wonderful, but it's not getting the message out to the people that need to hear it. So what we've tried to do is to go out to the associations that represent these different industry sectors. So for example, K through 12, there's like an association of school superintendents, and there's an association for school principals, and there's an association for school science teachers, and so forth and so on. So we are directly going to those societies and letting them know that this ebook is out there and that Commit to Care exists. We're also going out to state chambers of commerce, because we figure that these folks have access to small businesses, including schools, in the local communities. We're also going through the Small Business Administration. And so our conduit to these schools is very multi-channeled, if you will.
It's like the Swiss cheese.
Yeah. And so we're constantly trying to figure out, and we still have a lot more work to do. I mean, the ebook is wonderful. We're already updating the content in the ebook, and I'll come back at a future date and I'll let you know what we've changed in it, but we're already making modifications to its content. There'll be a version 2.0 later on this year. It's a work in progress. It's never going to just stop, you know, and not be updated, but we have to figure out a more effective way in getting this information in the hands of particularly K through 12 schools, child care facilities, long-term care facilities. Those are the target market segments that really helped us get the grant in the first place.
Well, we're going to stop and thank our sponsors for halftime. When we come back, I want to get into the document a little bit and kind of go through a couple specific scenarios so that our audience gets a feel for how it works in the real world. We'll be right back with Larry Sloan, the CEO, Chief Executive Officer of the American Industrial Hygiene Association. Association sponsors are AIHA, Healthy Workplaces, A Healthier World, AIHA.org. The Environmental Information Association, EIA's multidisciplinary membership, collects, generates, and disseminates information concerning environmental and occupational health hazards in the built environment at EIA-USA.org. The IICRC, a nonprofit standards development and certifying body for the cleaning and restoration industry, IICRC.org. The Restoration Industry Association, the oldest and largest nonprofit professional trade association dedicated to providing leadership and promoting best practices through advocacy, standards, and professional qualifications for the restoration industry at restorationindustry.org. Actionable insights. No more mistakes. No more missed line items in your Xactimate estimates at getinsights.org. Industry sponsors are Particles Plus, feature-rich particle counters and air quality instrumentation. Count on us. ParticlesPlus.com. BioPlanet at BYOPlanet.com. Improving human, animal, and environmental health with electrostatic spray technology and advanced chemistries at BioPlanet.com. Actionable insights at getinsights.org. All right, we're back with the second half with Larry. Larry Sloan, we got you back. Grayson, I want you to pull up the document, the ebook there. I'd like to kind of go through it a little bit for our audience. And while he's pulling that up, we got our up over a couple of the let's go back to the very beginning of the book here, Grayson. But Larry, I'm also curious about your outreach to other groups, like to building owners and managers. Do you have the same problems with that you have with the schools?
So as we developed the Back to Work Safely documents and then updated the materials in the ebook, not only did we reach out to the school associations that I mentioned earlier, but we also reached out to a variety of other associations, like, for example, BOMA and the International Facility Management Association. And so, you know, we've had a little better success with some of those groups. And then, you know, the industry trade groups like the National Restaurant Association, American Library Association, American Dental Association. I mean, we were reaching out to a variety of downstream associations, right, to help us with the guidance, to make sure that they felt that the guidance that we were including in the Back to Work Safely and then this ebook was practical for their constituents. So it's a continual work in progress. I would say that a lot of the relationships that we built from several years ago, we continue to build upon, and we have contacts at each and one of these associations. And so as we make updates to the material, we are reaching out to these associations and suggesting that they take a look at it and, you know, figure out how they can best disseminate the information to their constituents. It's an ongoing process.
Grayson, let's scroll down a little bit. Is this the actual book or just...
No, that's actually the landing page where you can download the book. Now you can click on that. I don't know how instantaneous
it
is. But
if you go up a little bit, it says download the book. Yeah. Why don't you download it?
There we go.
Now let's scroll down a little bit. There was a couple questions I had in here. Go ahead down to the table of contents. There we go. All right. So we start with an intro. We've talked a good bit about that. And then you go into different settings, I guess it would be. How did you determine these are the important settings?
Yeah, so when we put the Back to Work Safely documents together, you know, each one was for a different industry sector. That's why there were 27 of them. But then when we decided to harmonize the information and create this ebook, we knew that the guidance for specific industry sectors, there were commonalities right on the guidance. And so when you looked at the table of contents back in at the beginning there, we bucketed specific industries together where there was kind of a common risk profile. So for example, general office settings, you know, that's general office settings like that you and I are in right now. Service sector businesses like dry cleaners and banks and, you know, other retail establishments, we felt, okay, those are kind of common settings where you have traffic that's coming and going throughout the day. It's very different than a healthcare facility. And it's also very different than an educational facility like a K-12 classroom where you have students that might be spending more time in a particular classroom, or a teacher that might be in a particular classroom throughout the entire day versus a manufacturing setting. And so that's why we bucketed the guidance by these kind of aggregates of industry sectors based on the risk profile.
You know, what's kind of interesting, I want to focus on the educational facilities, but really they include general office settings, service sector settings. They have a nurse's office, sort of a healthcare. They have not too many manufacturing warehouse, but they have large venues, their auditoriums, they have outdoor activities, they've got transit, they kind of cover all of these. So I think they'd be a good one to focus on. Let's go to page 20, kind of run through how you use the book here. Educational facilities. Go ahead, Larry.
Yeah. So the first thing is there's an introduction to what, and that's a really good point, Joe, because, you know, it's not about necessarily the industry. If you are working in a meatpacking facility, let's just take that as an example, because that was in the news a lot in 2020, 2021. You could be in a room by yourself in an accounting capacity, right? You're the chief financial officer for a particular meatpacking company, and you are alone in that office, you know, 8, 9, 10 hours a day. Your risk profile is going to be pretty low. So you're not going to follow the guidance for manufacturing because you're not in the manufacturing sector. In other words, there are a lot of different work settings in a particular establishment where just because you work in a manufacturing plant, the nature of your job might put you in a different category, right? And a different risk profile. Yep. If you're sitting alone in an accounting office versus on the front line processing meat. So going back to chapter four here, there's a little bit of an introduction about educational facilities and what this section covers. This is, you know, K through 12, as well as institutions of higher education. And then you can see, as you go down the page, there's a take me to the employee section. And so for every industry sector, we created guidance for the employee as well as for the employer. And see, that jumps you to what is your responsibility as an employee? So what are things that you can do in your daily life as an employee at a K through 12 school? Well, for example, you want to comply with workplace health and safety policies. If there's online methodology that you can use, if you can teach online part of the week or all of the week, you should go ahead and do that. So forth and so on. And it talks about masks and how to properly wear and store a mask. And then going back up in the document is the employer side of things. And so each of these sections is set up in terms of guidance for the employer. And then farther down is guidance for the employee. And that's the organization of each one of these chapters. And if you go back up to the top of that chapter, you'll see these strategies that are designed for the employer are much more detailed, right? They start with ventilation strategies, improving your HVAC system, working with a qualified HVAC professional to make sure that your system is, you know, well-maintained, cleaning and replacing filters, maintaining clean air ducts, maximizing your outdoor air input based on your system design, getting that humidity in that 40 to 60% range, that type of thing. And then, you know, you get into CADR scores, right? That's instead of the air changes, you talk about CAD scores. The air delivery rate per person, which is really becoming more of the recommended strategy under that ASHRAE 241 standard that I talked about earlier. And this gets you into more of the specifics on how to design your HVAC system, how to make modifications to your HVAC system. These are all strategies that fall under the domain of the employer, not the employee. Okay, so then you go through, and this is a lot of specific bullets here to talk about things and changes you can make to improve your circulation flow. You can continue on the next page. We talk about physical distancing. So, you know, again, if you're a childcare facility, how do you instruct your staff and the visitors, the students themselves, the clients, customers, if you will, on spacing themselves out in the classroom, avoiding communal tables and work groups? Very, very common sense basic strategies that, quite frankly, are still being used in a lot of childcare facilities around the country. K through 12 schools, things that you should, marking floors. I do, I used to volunteer at night at one of the local schools helping foreigners, immigrants learn English. I did it for a little while last year. And we were at one of the local elementary schools and they had things still marked out on the floors. I thought it was still interesting how they were spacing the tables. So these are, again, common sense strategies for how the students should be spaced out in the classroom and even in the hallway. The hallways of this elementary school where I student taught had arrows on the floors, staggering activities. And then there's some guidance down on the page there for, you know, universities and colleges, very similar. And then we get into masking on the next page.
Cliff, I know you had a follow-up. Go ahead.
I did. And one of the things, Larry, it seems to me that a tremendous amount of effort and time went into putting this together. And many, many years ago, a good friend of mine who was probably a mentor to me, you know, 10, 15 years older, told me that people only appreciate two things, what they either earn or what they pay for. Okay, so the fact that you are disseminating this for free, I think makes someone who receives it think, because I'm getting it for free, it's really not that valuable.
You know? Interesting.
Like it seems like you may have an appreciation problem. And, you know, among the other distribution things, and I just wasn't sure whether you ever kind of focused on that or gave some thought to it, because there probably is a really logical, simple answer. I don't know what it is, but.
Well, the answer, quite frankly, is that under the mandate of the grant from the CDC,
right,
everything we produce has to be given out for free.
No, I understand that, but I'm just trying to figure out how you get these people, you know, like the, this is, if I knew that this was my tax dollars that, that paid for this, or, you know, what, you know, then I think I would appreciate it. I wasn't suggesting that you charge for it. I was just thinking that somehow people just need to know what went into this, you know, how many hours of volunteer time and, so on and so forth. Just,
it's an interesting point. Yeah. You know, you guys could buy a whole supply of these if you want. We'll take your donation.
Okay.
That's a really, no, it's a good point. It's a good point. And, you know, maybe we probably have not communicated out to these various stakeholders how much time and effort really went into the development of, well, not only the original Back to Work Safely, which then again created the ebook, but all of the other materials that are on the Commit to Care website. I mean, it's thousands of hours.
Also, if you put a value on it, like for just like if you hired an industrial hygienist, a CIH, to put this thing together, what would it have cost? Or, you know, and now you had many brains putting it together. So, you know, I just think that if you put a value on it, not only could it save potentially lives and so on and so forth, it's just, you know, it's worth, I think maybe if there's a price tag put on it, that this is the value of it, I think that people might.
Yeah, it's a really good point. It's a really, really good point. It's worth at least $19.95, I think. I mean, you know, talk about all the products that are available on television, but you know, it is that the dollar value of all of the work that's gone into the Commit to Care knowledge products and this ebook is it's got to be hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars if you start tallying up the value of an industrial hygienist, the CIH, and the number of hours and fact that there were multiple people that contributed to all of this guidance. It's a really, really important point. It's not lost on me, that's for sure.
Larry, I've got a text question from the audience that I want to kind of reword a little bit. How do you take into consideration people who have sensitivities or asthma or respiratory and cardiovascular conditions? Is that addressed in the book, how you address certain different subcategories of people?
We do reference that those that are immunocompromised or have underlying health conditions should take more stringent measures, right, to protect themselves. And so, you know, there are still folks that are walking around, and I travel a lot, as you know, and I'm seeing folks in airports and even one or two on airplanes that are wearing masks. Some of them are wearing N95s, for example. Some of our older luminary members, as I like to call them, are, you know, have health issues. And so they're wearing N95s when they're in public, when they come to an AIHA conference, for example. And I respect and I applaud folks that are taking proper individual protections. And I think that, you know, none of us knows what's happening in our homes, right? You may be perfectly healthy, but you may be living with somebody who's immunocompromised. So God forbid you bring something home. And so I think these people that are taking proper precautions, and we do mention this in the ebook, have a fundamental responsibility to protect the ones that they know and love. And so we do respect and we do recognize the fact that if you do have underlying health conditions, you should take additional measures to protect yourself.
As a somewhat of a follow-up to that, there's been, there was just a recent article, I think, in Science magazine, and there's been a movement in the academia and other places to regulate indoor air quality. Does AIHA have a position on that?
We believe, and there was a comment, I'm looking now at the thread, I agree with the comments here. You know, ASHRAE is doing a great job of, first of all, publishing that 241 standard in record time. And by the way, ASHRAE and AIHA, I'll put a plug in, we just formed a formal MOU, a memorandum of understanding between the two organizations, which is a really a big deal because it shows the interaction of the mechanical engineers, the HVAC professionals, and the industrial hygienists, and how they really do fit hand in glove. And so I want to just do a quick shout out to Don Weeks, who I believe is listening, because he was really instrumental in helping us forge that MOU. But when you talk about the, you know, the work that's being done within ASHRAE and the work that they're trying to do to influence building codes around the country, that's where this has to start. Because without that driver, without that motivation for folks to follow those codes, and if the codes aren't going to mandate a particular indoor air quality standard or methodology that should be deployed to improve the quality of indoor air, you know what? To the question that's posed here in the chat thread, nothing's going to get done. There has to be a mandate. There has to be a building code, construction code that helps folks improve the quality of the indoor air while they're building these new buildings or while they're doing retrofitting. And that's all the right challenge for us as a country. That is absolutely correct.
It is. It's a tough one. Let's go to the roundup, Grayson. So let's round things up here, Cliff. I'd like to go ahead and give you the first question, and then I've got a specific one for Larry before we wrap it up.
No, I was just thinking that, just handle the text questions or something like that, Joe, I guess. I was going to go through them. There was just one text question. Someone had wondered whether you could provide information about any big pharmaceutical products or other products being considered for use in your CDC grants.
Yeah, we have been very careful about not specifying particular products, pharmaceutical regimen, drug therapies, even technologies. You know, we're very careful to say filtration as a category or UVGI, but not specifying, you know, names or brands or. We have to be very mindful of that because this, again, is under, and not only the fact that it's a CDC grant funded project, but as an association, you know, we represent a lot of different stakeholders. And so we have to be very careful about not preferentially recommending even a particular technology or a systemology. So no, we cannot do that.
Larry, I got a question for you. I was surprised to see cleaning air ducts recommended in this document.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask you, I have not seen any evidence that cleaning air ducts helps with viruses or anything, let alone viruses. Was this controversial and how did it get in there?
So one of the partners is NADCA, N-A-D-A-C-A, N-A-D-C-A. I mean, you might be familiar with them.
National Air Duct Cleaners Association. Yes, sir.
Yeah, you might want to have them on a future show. And Jody is the CEO of that group. And she and I exchanged notes about this guidance several years ago. She's become a close colleague of ours. And, you know, when I mentioned to her I was going to be on the show today, and I said, you know, here's a question, Jody. And she goes, you know, Larry, first of all, thank you so much. If you wouldn't mind putting in a plug for what we do, they are conducting research as we speak. And they've got a study going on with the Denver public school system where they're looking at how HVAC system cleaning can demonstrate, if you will, improved indoor air quality. And so they've been doing some fundamental research, and they've got one of the local universities that's involved in this particular study. And they are looking at the cleaning of air ducts and the frequency of the cleaning of the air ducts and how that might mitigate the transfer of airborne transmitted disease. And so we don't have final definitive research on it, but when we put this guidance together, we thought that just general maintenance of your HVAC systems and periodically cleaning those ducts is not a bad idea, because remember, these tiny little particles that are being emitted by you and me are going to glom onto those particles in the air, right? And if the air ducts are dirty, there's particles that are going to be recirculating through your system. They're going to attract those respiratory globules, and that's going to be recirculated through the system. So from a common sense perspective, you would think that the cleaner your air ducts are, the better the quality of the indoor air, because you're not going to have that seeding, if you will, where the particle is going to have that agglomeration with the respiratory globule that's being emitted from the mouth or the nose. So stay tuned for further research on this.
All right. We will do that. And we'll have to, the University of Colorado has done a lot with the Denver schools, and we've had a few shows on that. And I think follow up with them. The other kind of controversial talked about it earlier was masking, and I did want to note that in the document you do point out that, you know, it's not just throwing a piece of cloth on your face, and you give some good suggestions for how to make sure that if you're going to use masks, you use them properly. And I wonder if you could touch on that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we talked earlier about, you know, N95s being kind of the gold standard and the fact that you really need to be fitted properly with the N95. And that's just not going to happen in most business establishments, right? Unless you're mandated by OSHA, you're not going to have that expertise. And so the next best thing is to don a surgical mask or a cloth mask. And so, you know, there's a way of putting on the mask, you know, make sure you don't touch the face of the mask with your hands, right? You want to use the strings as you wrap them around your ears, and then taking off of the mask, starting on one side and then carefully removing it from the other. And, you know, you can launder your masks, of course, and they last a certain amount of time. And so I think that the way you handle your mask and being careful not to touch the surface of the mask with your fingers is just a very common sense approach to managing it. And please wear the mask over your mouth and your nose. It's not going to do you any service if it's being worn below your nose. I'm in the supermarket all the time, and the ladies and the men in the checkout counters are wearing them like this. It's not helping you.
Well, the other recommendations I thought were good was to get a mask with a clip that gives a better seal around your nose.
If you could.
To make sure that the mask goes below your chin, as far as, you know, the width and the height of it, I guess it would be. I thought those were two good ones. The other question I had on the masking and N95s, and maybe you don't know off the top of your head, but does an N95 require a medical evaluation?
The N95 requires you need a consultant to come in and do the official, you know, formal fit testing. When you say medical evaluation, I don't believe there's a requirement of medical evaluation. If you're in a protected work environment that's being mandated by OSHA where the respiratory protection is required, then yes, you need to go through and you need to make sure that folks are fitted properly. Somebody else from the audience might be able to comment on the medical evaluation. I don't have a specific, I don't want to misstate the facts there.
Understood. And I don't want to catch you off guard on that. Let me ask
you a good question.
Before we go, we always like to give you the last word. And as a part of that, if you could, maybe you could tell our audience about any initiatives or up and coming things that AIHA is working on.
Well, we're working on a lot of very exciting projects that goes above and beyond Commit to Care. But I do want to put a shout out about a brand new project. It's a heat stress app. And this is the first app that AIHA has ever developed. And we're really excited about it because one of our working groups, our thermal stress working group, has been clamoring for a new app to be developed, because the original app that's still out there that's been produced from OSHA and NIOSH is just based on the, you know, temperature and humidity, you know, the heat index. And, you know, through studies, we've learned that the heat index is really not an effective measure of indicating one's heat stress. And so we're creating a new app that's going to drop around June the 1st, and it's going to be best based on the wet bulb globe temperature adjusted value. So it's going to pull live weather data from your GPS coordinates, and then it's going to ask you questions about your workload exertion, the kind of clothing you're wearing, and other questions. And that's going to figure into the calculation to assess your heat stress. And then based on that heat stress risk level, it's going to give you guidance on how to cool down, if you will. And so we're really excited about this tool. It's going to be, again, sorry, Cliff, completely free. you know, I mean, we want to get it out there to as many people as possible. It's not going to have pop-up ads or anything else that's going to annoy or compromise the user experience. But we're really excited about the release of this app around June the 1st. And it's going to be in four different languages. It's going to be in English, Spanish, French, and Portuguese. So the four most commonly spoken languages in the Western Hemisphere. But it's going to be released around the world. And we've got folks excited both within, you know, NIOSH and OSHA and all these allied associations and others that are out there that we're going to promote it through.
It's so nice to see over our career here, Cliff and I have been doing this for quite a while. It's nice to see that collaboration occurring between organizations. I think that's a really positive trend, and I'm glad to see you emphasize it as much as you have.
This is one of the major reasons why I'm still at AIHA, is the spirit of collaboration. And, you know, folks like Don and many, many others that are behind these relationships, ASSP, National Safety Council, the OCDOCs, the OCD nurses, Environmental Associations, NEHA, NAEM. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. We've got relationships. Some are formal and some are informal, as you know. And, you know, the beauty of us is how we can come together and sensibly collaborate. Where does it make sense for the betterment of both organizations.
And also, we're looking forward to doing a show with one of your experts on fire. I know Cliff just got back from RIA, and the Restoration Industry Association is really concerned about some of the stuff coming out on smoke, wildfire smoke in particular, I think. And it's a very timely topic, along with the fact that, you know, with climate heat getting high, you know, more of a problem, having that heat stress app coming out too, I think is another very timely topic. So we always appreciate having you, Larry. Thank you so much.
Thank you both very much. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Our thanks to this week's guest, Larry Sloan, the AIHA's Chief Executive Officer. My thanks to my co-host, the Z-Man, Cliff Zlotnick, John Grayson. I almost said, John, you got to have faith there. Grayson, Gone Fishing Fisher. Thanks, Grayson. And most importantly, our loyal audience and sponsors, we really appreciate it. We're going to be off next week, but we'll be back in 2 weeks. And we're probably going to talk a little bit about fire in a couple weeks. So please come back and join us for the next episode of IAQ Radio Plus.
For IAQ Radio, I'm Spike Reel saying thanks for listening.